The notion that I hear is that the Russians are experiencing today anyway, 1/10 of the casualty rate of the Ukrainians. That is plausible, in which case the range would be 10,000 or 15,000 Russian deaths and not 100,000.
Okay, we appreciate that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. Thank you, Gilbert Dockerell, independent international affairs analyst, and Fred Weir, thank you, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. And that does for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tagway and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21 of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Young.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا سواء علينا الرخيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran says the adoption of a U.S.-backed resolution to remove the country from the U.N. Women Commission is politically motivated and against the U.N. Charter. In Britain, 100,000 nurses are walking off the job, canceling thousands of non-urgent operations and outpatient appointments. Plus, Peru declares a nationwide state of emergency amid violent protests against the ouster of ex-president Pedro Castillo. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran has strongly condemned the adoption of a U.S.-backed resolution by the UN Economic and Social Council to remove the Islamic Republic from the Commission on the Status of Women. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani described the move as politically motivated and illegitimate. He said the resolution also contravened the UN Charter and set a wrong precedent in the international body. Kanani added that through his hostile move, the U.S. intends to impose its unilateral political demands on international organizations. The spokesman said that it's ironic that despite all its crimes against Palestinians, Israel is still a member of the Commission on the Status of Women. He noted that U.S. has been extensively violating the rights of Iranian women through imposition of unilateral sanctions during past decades and is in no position to advocate their rights.
The streets in front of the United Nations office in Tehran once again became the scene of peaceful protests. This time, a group of Iranian activists and students gathered to condemn an attempt by several Western governments to remove Iran from the Commission on the Status of Women, or CSW, over what they call the Iranian government's violations of women's rights and crackdown on protests.
We are here on behalf of all women who are deprived of education and a normal life to say that Islam guarantees the rights of women and gives them freedom.
Because it is with hijab where we can come out, express our identity, express our personality.
According to a statement by the protesters, the Commission on the Status of Women has never questioned its members for violating women's rights, but now it has suddenly become a supporter of Iranian women's rights.
Eliminating Iran from the UN Women's Commission doesn't make us upset, because the record of this commission is full of contradictions, and its silence regarding the situation of women in certain member states raises a lot of questions.
Basically, they are protesting the hypocrisy that is taking place. It's ironic that the countries that are really leading this charge, United States, France, England, and we see the reality that is taking place inside of these countries. So on the one hand, we have so much hypocrisy, because we know at the very beginning of how this started, that one woman all of a sudden got the attention of the world, and we know, especially myself, as an American, as a black American, that women in general are not that important for them.
The protesters' main concern is the fact that Western diplomats and rights activists have attempted to remove Iran from the CSW, while international institutions have been pursuing a contradictory approach on women's rights for years, and women have time and again fallen victim to political schemes.
The demonstrators have gathered here in the capital, Tehran, to send a message that they are the true face of Iranian women. They're also demanding the United Nations to remain impartial despite pressure from certain countries. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Iranian parliament condemns the Western sanctions on Iran's English language news channel Press TV and the subsequent decision of Europe's satellite operator, Eutelsat, to take it off the air. In a statement, Iranian lawmakers said the EU measures that led to the satellite blackout are a clear example of violation of freedom of expression. They stress that the action is politically motivated and based on false accusations. According to the statement, the move is aimed at silencing any voice that reflects the truth and opposes views of the mainstream media. But it emphasized that Press TV will remain the voice of the voiceless. Last week, France-based Eutelsat notified Press TV that it would cease its transmission in line with the sanctions. Recently, the EU imposed sanctions on 29 Iranian individuals and three organizations, including Press TV, over Iran's response to the riots in the country. Iran's southwestern Abadan refinery is the oldest oil refinery in the country. The plant has embarked on a mega project aimed at modernizing its deteriorating equipment. Yusuf Jalali reports from the city of Abadan.
The first oil refinery in the Middle East, located in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, near the western coast of the Persian Gulf, the Abadan refinery was launched in 1912. However, due to the deterioration of its old plants, it has undergone fundamental renovation since 2005, aiming to optimize the quality of its products and stabilize its processing capacity at 360,000 barrels per day.
We renew or establish some new refinery in two parts. One part with 150,000 barrels per day in more than 15 years ago. Now we established the new phase one with 210,000 barrels. The sum of the phase one and two is 360,000 barrels per day as a new capacity and a new refinery.
The second renovation phase, with a capacity of 210,000 barrels per day, needs 2.6 billion euros to be accomplished. But due to the Western sanctions, the project's financial resources face challenges.
Because of sanctions, we cannot follow, we cannot get the full finance. This finance is break to half the finance or the investment of this project, more than 1 billion euro up to now. And in the future, in the next year, we start the phase two or section two of this project to complete the refinery.
All of the products at the new phase of the Abadan refinery will be produced with a Euro 5 standard, which makes them more eco-friendly.
With the environmental aspect, sulfur recovery, more than 160,000 per day as the capacity of the sulfur unit to remove the all pollution from the oil and products of this refinery.
Phase two of the Abadan refinery will include the construction of hydrogen production units, hydrocrackers, a liquefied petroleum gas distillation unit, and ancillary facilities.
Its authorities say once the project comes on stream, the Abadan refinery will turn into an energy hub in the country by 2025. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Abadan.
British nurses begin their strike in their first ever national walkout amid a bitter dispute with the government over pay. An estimated 100,000 nurses are walking off the job at nearly 80 hospitals and health centers. The walkout will cancel thousands of non-urgent operations and tens of thousands of outpatient appointments. It's also scheduled to take place next Tuesday. The strike has no precedent in the British Nursing Union's 106-year history. Nurses want a 19% pay rise, arguing they have suffered a decade of real terms cuts. On Wednesday, the Prime Minister and the opposition party leader had a heated debate on the issue.
Mr. Speaker, nurses going on strike is a badge of shame for this government. Instead of showing leadership, he's playing games with people's health.
It's right, if he thinks it's right, that pay demands of 19% are met, then he should say so. What's weak, Mr. Speaker, is he's not strong enough to stand up to the union.
The government has so far refused to discuss pay, saying it cannot afford to pay more than 4 to 5% offered to nurses. Britain is facing a wave of industrial actions this winter, with strikes crippling the rail network and postal service, while airports are bracing for disruptions over Christmas.
More picket lines and travel disruptions as tens of thousands of rail workers across Britain walk out. Represented by the RMT Union, for months they have been asking the government for better working conditions and an increase in their pay to match the double-digit inflation. The government says the pay rises are unaffordable and has promised tough action against the unions. The unions say they're standing firm.
This latest round of strikes will show how important our members are to the running of the country and will send a clear message that we want a good deal on job security, pay and conditions for our people. We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
The strikes come at a cost to the economy in terms of lost working days. And the right-wing media here have been counting that cost. Yet that doesn't seem to have dented public support for the strikers.
The cost of living has gone up, so if they're doing more money, then they should get a pay rise.
I can see where the rail workers are coming from. They want a pay rise. They're seeing their bills go up every month, and they want to make sure they can support their families. At the same time, the government has a really tricky job on its hands to deal with inflation.
I support the strikes and things just because I feel like in certain sectors a lot of people deserve a pay rise anyway at the minute, especially with inflation. But us as travellers on holiday in London as such, obviously it's been a bit of an inconvenience to us.
The rail workers' walkout comes amid a cost of living crisis that's seen food and energy prices soar to 40-year highs since the start of the Ukraine war, pushing millions of Britons into poverty. Staff at the crisis-hit National Health Service will also be going on strike this week for the first time in more than 100 years, and the number of sectors joining the strike action is only growing.
We may not see a general strike in the traditional sense, but the way things are going, it is likely that the different trade unions will synchronize and coordinate their action to maximize their leverage for a better deal with the government. Saeed Bariza, London.
Moving on to Peru, where unrest continues with protesters turning out in force across different cities against the ouster and detention of ex-president Pedro Castillo. The protesters have blocked the streets, set fire to buildings, and invaded airports. In the capital, Lima, and many rural communities, they're demanding the closure of the Congress and the resignation of the new president, Dina Boluarte. Peru plunged into turmoil when Castillo was impeached and arrested after he announced plans to dissolve the Congress. His former vice president, Dina Boluarte, was immediately sworn into office, but that even further angered Castillo's supporters. 8 people, mostly teenagers, have been killed in the latest street clashes with police. A national state of emergency is now in place as part of the government plans to quell the demonstrations.
We have agreed to declare a state of emergency throughout the country due to the acts of vandalism and violence.
The minister said the state of emergency will be expanded for the next 30 days. The announcement came as a judge ordered Castillo to remain in prison in charges of rebellion and conspiracy for another 48 hours ahead of a release hearing. Meantime, prosecutors are seeking 18 months of pretrial detention for Castillo. And the United States continues to be racked by exceptionally high inflation. Seemingly every other major economic indicator also remains mired in long-term problems as American festive holiday season approaches. Rami Mazari has more from Chicago.
Inflation in the United States continues to be near a four-decade high, with the latest data showing it still remains above 7%. The real number is even worse, as food prices climbed significantly, but the government excludes food and energy costs from their official rate.
There aren't immediate solutions to really help people because this inflation is what it is, and it's not looking to get any better anytime soon. The government, the news puppeteers, they all want to claim that inflation is because of Russia or because of this or that. No, inflation is a gun they've been loading for years and decades.
Corporate profits haven't just risen, they've exploded to an all-time record of $2 trillion last quarter. That's a stunning $1 trillion jump from 2020. Also headed in the wrong direction are recurring unemployment claims, which saw the biggest jump since May 2020 and are at their highest level in nearly a year.
Seemingly every day, new mass layoffs are being announced, and especially in the tech sector. With a double-dip recession appearing likely and perhaps prolonged, more job cuts are expected this winter.
American high finance is desperate for the central bank to return to low interest rates and the no-strings-attached policy of quantitative easing. But many say that no amount of spin can hide inflation's negative effects on the average household.
The Federal Reserve, which is appointed by Democrats and Republicans, is something that has set a 2-3% inflation rate for most of history, recent history. But even at 2-3%, the dollar loses half of its purchase power every 27 to 35 years. So that means if you're saving money for retirement, you're going to need to save at least twice as much, maybe four times, depending on when you start to save. So inflation is something our founders did not want. That's why they had a gold standard.
What's not rising are wages, which fell for the 20th consecutive month. Christmas is less than 2 weeks away, and polls say that economic hardship will force half of Americans to spend less on their loved ones this season. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Elsewhere, thousands of Gazans thronged downtown Gaza City on Wednesday to mark the 35th anniversary of Hamas's founding. The event was a massive display that showed the broad support to the Palestinian resistance movement by people in the blockaded coastal territory. Press TV's correspondent Asher Shannon has more details in the following story.
In a mass rally and under a sea of green flags, men and women from all walks of life came out to take part in Hamas's 35th anniversary celebration. Hamas, who was founded in 1987, won the Palestinian parliamentary elections in January 2006, but remains blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime. The movement has fought several wars against the Israeli regime since 2007. People from all walks of life attending the rally called on all Palestinian factions to increase the resistance against the Israeli occupation to bring about the liberation of Al-Quds.
We will continue to support Hamas and the resistance until we liberate every inch of our land. We call on the Muslim nation to support Palestine and to support Al-Quds. People came out today to send a strong message of support to the resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Hamas supporters said they want the Israelis to know that the Islamic resistance movement is a force to be reckoned with.
We are here today to express our support to Hamas on its anniversary and to tell the whole world that Palestinians are supporting the resistance. Hamas has a very strong military wing that continues to grow. Hamas, along with all the resistance factions, will continue to fight for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
35 years on, Hamas continues to garner support due to its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
People here say that despite years of siege and multiple wars, Hamas movement has managed to defy all odds and survive all attempts to weaken it. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent trip to Saudi Arabia, his participation in the summit of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, PGCC, and signing several agreements for cooperation with Saudi Arabia have angered current and former U.S. officials. Following the differences between Riyadh and Washington over the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi and OPEC Plus decision to cut oil output but to 2 million barrels per day, the Saudi kingdom seemingly seek a more east-oriented approach and is trying to improve its relations with Beijing. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. Fox News reported recently former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent visit to Saudi Arabia, signaling a warming of relations at a time of heightened tensions between the United States and both countries, was a result of bad American policy. The Chinese leader was warmly welcomed in Saudi Arabia, a landmark trip that stood in sharp contrast to the lukewarm welcome U.S. President Joe Biden received when he visited the kingdom early this year. Pompeo blamed the flawed policy of the Biden administration for antagonizing Saudi Arabia, a traditional U.S. ally in West Asia, and causing it to hedge its relationship with Washington. Pompeo said, "When you want to be partners with your friends and your allies, and you offend them, and you simply won't do anything to push back against your adversaries, you see exactly this kind of hedging behavior." In a jab at the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump, who had aligned his West Asia policy closely with Saudi Arabia, Biden had promised on the campaign trail to treat the kingdom like a pariah on the international stage. Relations between the two allies deteriorated during Biden's presidency over oil production, human rights, and other issues. Pompeo said, while alienating Saudi Arabia, the Biden administration has also gone soft on China, which he said the former administration had recognized as the singular greatest external threat to the United States. He said, when you do those things, you will hurt the American people all across this country. And what you saw happen in the kingdom recently is a direct result of bad American policy. The former diplomat added, you've got to stick with friends, you've got to stay with your partners, and you must push back against your adversaries, or your friends will begin to hedge. Right, they'll go make friendships to protect themselves if they can't count on America to be a good partner and friend around the world. According to a joint statement published by Saudi Arabia, Riyadh and Beijing were keen to stress the importance of stability in the world oil markets, noting that Saudi Arabia is a reliable exporter of crude oil to its Chinese partner. Back in October, Biden considered that the U.S. needed to rethink its relationship with Saudi Arabia after OPEC Plus slashed oil production. Biden's repeated calls for the kingdom to increase production to stabilize the markets and lower energy prices continue to fall on deaf ears. Meanwhile, the MiddleEastMonitor.com writes, the White House recently responded to Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to Saudi Arabia by claiming that Beijing's attempts to spread influence worldwide is not conducive to international order. Asked about Xi's visit, White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby told reporters that Saudi Arabia remains a crucial U.S. ally, but he issued a warning over China. He said, we are mindful of the influence that China is trying to grow around the world. West Asia is certainly one of those regions where they want to deepen their level of influence. He claimed, we believe that many of the things they are trying to pursue and the manner in which they are trying to pursue it are not conducive to preserving the international rules-based order. Kirby said, we are not asking nations to choose between the U.S. and China, but as the President Biden has said many times, we believe that in this strategic competition, the U.S. is certainly well poised to lead. Relations between Washington and Riyadh deteriorated in 2018 following the assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident. Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul on October 2, 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi regime and the crown prince. The CIA, in a report, said that Khashoggi's murder was directly ordered by the Saudi de facto ruler, and the claim has been corroborated by many leading global human rights organizations. Also, tensions erupted over the Saudi-led OPEC Plus decision to cut production to raise oil prices, which was viewed by the Biden administration as potentially harming his Democratic Party in this year's midterm elections. Kirby said Saudi Arabia had been a strategic U.S. partner for nearly 80 years, but noted that Biden has ordered a review of ties. Kirby said, "Yes, in the wake of the OPEC Plus decision a couple of months ago, we are reviewing that bilateral relationship and making sure that it best suits American national security interests. That work is ongoing." Furthermore, the website of Shia News reports since Saudi Arabia led OPEC Plus decision to cut oil output by 2 million barrels a day in what Riyadh said was a necessary move that was economically motivated, the White House announced that it would review U.S.-Saudi ties, claiming the oil cut was a political move to support Moscow in its special operation in Ukraine. Following U.S. attempts to pressure Riyadh into reversing the decision, which was described by Turkey as a U.S. attempt to bully Saudi Arabia, several member states of OPEC Plus, the producer group comprising the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries plus its allies, reiterated there is consensus among OPEC Plus countries that this is the best decision, a preemptive move in light of uncertainty and lack of clarity looming in the horizon. Allies for decades, Washington and Riyadh, have been keeping their differences behind closed doors. But the tension on OPEC Plus oil cut broke out into the open, demonstrating broken relations and lack of trust. The two allies were unable to hide the heated spat over oil production amid Saudi concerns over the Biden administration and where it stands. 2 months after the rise of tensions between Riyadh and Washington, the oil-rich country rolled out the red carpet for China's president, giving him a warm welcome, unlike his U.S. counterpart. Saudi TV channels showed a grand ceremony at Al Yamamah Palace, during which Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, received the Chinese leader. The warm welcoming of Chinese president comes contrary to the frosty reception of U.S. President Joe Biden a few months ago. Of course, it is also important to remind that Saudi Arabia did not congratulate Biden on his official inauguration and entry to the White House. Analysts have said the contrast between Xi Jinping's grand welcome and Biden's cold fist bump during his visit to the kingdom highlights how Saudi Arabia sees itself having more in common with China than with the U.S. At a time the U.S. is seen as seeking its own interests on behalf of all other nations, the Persian Gulf countries, led by Saudi Arabia, seemingly seek a more east-oriented approach that defies U.S. dictations. Such developments indicate the diminishing role of the United States as the dominant power and center of governance. The occurrence of such encounters in itself is considered historic and indicates that a new world order is becoming more and more realistic.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
No one is illegal.
Part 2.
Me trajeron aquí mismo.
I was brought here to Tarifa, to this center. When we got here, it was very late at night. We were all in handcuffs. Around 20 police officers stood around us watching us. They gave us food, a blanket, a towel, toothbrush, soap, and then we were sent to a room. They showed us the rooms and all that. The next morning, a doctor came to give us all a medical review. They gave us some pills, and that was it. I took them without knowing what they even were. Inside the center, it's like a prison. There are bunk beds, one on top of the other. There are no sanitary conditions, and bathrooms are terrible. It's horrible. Also, the blanket and towel, everything smelled awful, and the cell was cold inside because it was January. The cold was unbearable. It was dark because in our section, the lights weren't working.
La manta, la toalla, todo esto apestaba. Y la celda dentro hacía un frío porque era enero, hacía un frío que no podía.
In the mornings they would take us out to the yard for half an hour to an hour, but that was never enough. Basically half an hour, and then inside again. Bored, we would play cards or something else to get distracted. That was all. Then we went to bed to sleep. You see the world from a different perspective in that place.
Aburrido. Nosotros jugamos a carta. A juego para distraernos, nada más, y después a la cama, a dormir. Ahí dentro tú ves el mundo diferente.
Cuando estuve en Senegal, yo me...
When I was in Senegal, I thought I was living in a paradise. But then, soon after I arrived, I faced huge problems and difficulties. I would ask myself why I didn't stay in my country, in my own country. The day we arrived on the island of Del Hierro, a lawyer came and told us that we had nothing to be worried about. She said she was there to help us, and that she was our lawyer. But that was the last time we saw her since we got off the ship near Tenerife. The policemen had their offices there in the building, and the Red Cross came to assist some of us who were sick. There were 16 people to a room. We had bunk beds. It was the raining season. It rained all the time, which completely flooded the room. Life was very hard there.
In ese momento llovía, y cada vez que llovía, el dormitorio se llenaba de agua y todo. Digamos una vida difícil, ¿eh?
It's a hostile place, a place where you feel really alone. The cell door is open because there's a yard. The mattress was made of plastic. Blankets smelled terribly. The water was cold and the food, something basic, very basic. For breakfast, bread, butter, and milk with cold coffee. Nothing hot was available. While you ate your meal, the cameras watched you. The police would watch you from the other side. You can't take anything with you back to the room. It's forbidden to have a mobile phone. And if you want to make a phone call, you have to pay. The prices charged for things are extremely high, and everything around you is destroyed. Even with a daily cleaning service that disinfects everything, it's impossible to sit on a toilet. It's impossible to take a shower or even try to. I used to put a trash bag on the floor, the only one we were given, so as not to have any direct contact with the floor. 10 days later, I received a letter saying that I was going to be released because someone had requested a pardon of my sentence, which was delivered in Madrid. Once it was received in Madrid, they released me.
It was a normal day. I was heading out to see my girlfriend when a car pulled up next to me. It was the police asking for my ID. I said I had nothing on me, and so they took me to the police station. They took my fingerprints, gave me an order of deportation, and took me to Algeciras, to the CIE of Algeciras, preparing to send me back to my country. The detention center of Algeciras is like a living hell. No human being deserves to live the way they live there.
Ningún ser humano merece vivir de esa forma de lo que está haciendo ahí.
It is well known migration law establishes that detention centers can't have a prison nature. But let's not fool ourselves. The detention center of Algeciras is the old prison of Algeciras. The prison was closed because, surprisingly, it didn't pass the required conditions to house people that were there serving a prison term. And I say surprisingly because if it was not appropriate to house prisoners, apart from having to serve a sentence according to our Spanish constitution, how is it now appropriate to house these people who have only committed an administrative infringement?
Sí puede servir para aquellas personas que exclusivamente han cometido una infracción administrativa.
Primero tú llegas.
When you first arrive, they frisk you, and before that, they provide you with documents setting out your rights, and in Spanish, French, English, for those who speak other languages. If you don't speak those languages, it means nothing to you. After that, they give you a towel, like they do here, only dirtier, dirtier. The worst thing is the toilets. They smell very bad, and also food is impossible to eat. It's not the way to treat a human being. There's no reason to treat us like that. I get very angry because of that. The police officers are very violent there. They do everything there with brutality. They tell you, you go there, come here, make a line. And they do it while beating you and beating other people. And it hurts. It really hurts. I remember one day we were having lunch and there was a guy, I don't know what he did, something with the food, yes. The officer told him to sit down in a certain place, but he said he wanted to go somewhere else. Then the officer said no and came to him and they were beating and beating him so bad that his back swelled up. The thing is that they have the last word, and we have to do whatever they say. Nobody can talk. There was a child crying and shouting who was running under a table. Then the officer grabbed him by the hand and started beating him. That's not right.
It is established by law that we have to be there. But to be honest, the only work we do there is surveillance. The only thing that we can say on behalf of the National Police Department, by judicial decree, we have to watch the people who are in the detention centers for immigrants. But they have all their rights, except for the right to freedom. We don't have any power at all to change things. We only have the duty to enforce the law. That's our job. I don't understand at all why a police officer would want to intentionally harm or cause physical damage to inmates. A police police officer earns 1,600 euros a month, so it would be really stupid to harm someone by doing so endanger his economical stability, the stability of his family and his livelihood. As in every other job, a police officer makes mistakes, but that's what laws are for. Criminal law is not aimed at police officers, but the internal regulation are actually stricter than the criminal law. There are isolated problems, but it is one case out of 1,000. There are also the rogue inmates. And I think it's logical to detainees that if you present a report against a police officer, that is, the person in charge of their surveillance, they can delay or even avoid their deportation out of Spain. We are allowing, I mean, the law is allowing this practice, and it's terrible.
Estamos dando, las leyes están dando lugar a esta picaresca, y esto es tremendo.
Pero también hay que tener en cuenta otra realidad.
But we should realize that many, or at least some of the detainees, come across from other penitentiaries where violence might have been used to try to obtain more freedom or better conditions.
Para intentar obtener o bien supuesta libertad.
In those places, I've seen handmade guns produced by the inmates. It's scandalous. I've seen spikes made out of a toothbrush, even chain sticks made also of toothbrush. I mean, you can find anything.
If you are thinking that the way these places operate is complicated, Conrado's case is much harder to understand. A young man born in Spain who, after 30 years, received an order to be deported out of his own country.
I was sent to the detention center due to a low-level case of drug dealing. I served 3 years in the prison at the penitentiary center of Mansilla de Leon. On my last day, my mother came to look after me, and when I came out, I found the national police waiting there for the purpose of deporting me to Cape Verde, my parents' country. I was born in Bienvivre, a village in Leon, Bierzo. I have been living there my whole life. My parents came from Cape Verde 35 years ago. How is it possible that a person who was born in Spain is sent to a detention center for migrants? The truth is that I don't know why. They say it's because I haven't a Spanish ID card. I've always been here legally. I've always had all my papers in order. I've had a residence permit all this time, but I don't have a national ID card because of a lack of care. You know, I never thought that something like this could ever happen to me, just for not having my ID card. When I came here to Madrid, to Aluche, and I landed in this center, a place with neither head nor tail. It's the food, the behavior, the sanitary conditions, a bit of everything. It's like being in jail, or perhaps even worse. At least in jail you have a TV or a radio. From your room you can't see anything. You don't see anything, just a piece of the road outside. The view is blocked. The dome blocks the exterior view. When a person first arrives, they have the right to make a phone call to their family. I sometimes asked new inmates if they were permitted to make their phone call, if the guard had let them do it, because people were asking me for money all the time to make phone calls. The thing is that the guard didn't inform them of their rights. Then I had to go personally to tell the guard to let them call. I would tell them, this kid has been here for a week, he has to call his family. This used to happen not only with one inmate, but 15 at a time.
According to the current law, there is a maximum period of stay of 60 days at a detention center for migrants. If you are not deported by that time, you can never be remanded there again.
El día de mi cumpleaños me dieron el billete de avión para irme a Cabo Verde. Me llevaron para el aeropuerto.
The day of my birth, I was given a plane ticket to go to Cape Verde. I was taken to Madrid airport. Once I arrived, I was led to an office, and then they forced me into a straitjacket. Of course, I asked them why they were doing that to me. I didn't kill anyone. I was told it was for my own safety. I tied my feet and hands together. When it was time, they escorted me to the plane. When I got off the transfer car, I cried out that I didn't want to board, and I threw myself on the tarmac. The policeman grabbed me. One held me by the neck, another used his knee against my crotch, and a third was trying to suffocate me with the jacket he was wearing. He had it all over my face, trying to suffocate me. Then the captain of the plane came out and refused to let me fly.
I worked in immigrant affairs for a short time. I was there for a year. And sometimes, yes, I had to. A couple of times I had to deport people. We took them to the plane, passed them to the authorities, and then we came back. Minimum physical force is implied to ensure secure, safe conditions. If the person becomes aggressive, of course, you have to act firmly. But if not, there is no need. If a person doesn't want to be deported, he or she won't be deported. Enforcement is not in the power of the police. So deportees take desperate actions. Once, someone stripped naked on the airplane, and the captain feared a scandal, so told us all to get off. That was the end of that deportation. What I mean is that it's logical and humane that a person would use all the resources at their disposal to avoid being deported from this so-called paradise.
The second time they tried to deport me, it was obvious that the officers were angry because the first time they didn't succeed. So the second time they were like, how should I call it, using a lot of psychological pressure. They were insulting me, saying racial insults. I mean, they were beating their chests to scare me. So when I got to the plane and the captain said that he wouldn't let me fly with handcuffs, they got even more pissed off and they brought me here. That was after 55 days of being in the country. So I stayed there 3 extra days and after that they set me free. Well, they didn't really set me free. The thing is that under law, you can't stay for more than 60 days. And I was here for 58 days, and it's hard to find a flight out. So I had reached the time limit of deportation, and that's why they had to let me go. But now I can't work or do anything.
Apart from the human suffering it provokes and being unfair, it's very inefficient because the effective rate of repatriation is very low. Out of all the cases applied, only half result in deportation. And why does that happen? Because either it is people without documents and it's impossible to prepare them, or for other reasons it's not possible to deport that person. An example is with newcomers who come undetected to our coast, especially if they come by pateras, boats, or through the Spanish cities of Ceuta or Melilla.
Sometimes this situation, you think that these detentions are ordered, knowing that the case will become a deportation that is not possible to be executed.
I think it is part of a prosecution and oppression process to make migrants feel unsafe here and force them to leave. It's also hard to make the various embassies collaborate in the identification of its nationals, because when they are deported, the home country has to recognize the nationality of these people, but in many cases they don't do it. There are also some consulates, like the Algerian one in the city of Alicante, that asks for money to give to the Spanish authorities. In other words, they demand a bribe, and they get it. The bribe is 15 euros if the person is in good health and 20 euros for a pregnant woman or someone that is wounded or hospitalized.
Politically, it's not correct to determine that some deportations are not going to be executed. That's a falsity. Why? Because in the end, you're creating an image in the public eye that migrants are not being deported. I think what should be done with public opinion is some kind of a teaching approach to educate them that, yes, we try to deport them, but sometimes we can't.
Humanitarian organizations like SOS Racist are trying to stop deportations with specific actions in airports.
We're informing the passengers on the flight to Dakar at 17:50 that there's going to be an expulsion on their flight, to inform the crew that they can oppose this kind of action. The passengers can take action too. They can refuse to fly while there's a person being deported on their flight. They can refuse to take a seat and so on. This way, it might be stopped.
In order to deport these people, a commercial flight can be used. You know what I mean, a flight of tourists. The flights for Marco deportations are done by Air Europa, and there's a campaign against it because the company has signed a contract for 12 million euros. Those flights are very difficult to detect because they are planned in advance and involve the consulates of the home countries, the airline, and the Interior Ministry, which is responsible for the payment and arrangement of flights. On those flights, people are not able to offer any resistance because there are no civilians to witness what goes on, and so the police brutality was intense. Many deportees were beaten, and so it was better not to resist because they would deport you by all means.
I wish there was a world without borders. It's a utopian idea. Unfortunately, due to all the different resources and people who want to protect the riches at their disposal, divisions and borders are created.
It's written in law that the state has control of its borders and the people from foreign countries living in their territories. That said, if I'm asked about the current model of the detention centers, clearly I will say I don't like it. What I think, though, is that they will remain, whether we like it or not.
As a police officer, I wish there were no jails or detention centers for immigrants, or CIEs. If a person or NGO comes and tells me that they are against CIEs, I will say that as a police officer, I also disagree. But I would ask that person to find a solution to that problem, because criticizing is easier than actually solving the problem.
I think that history will judge us very harshly for restricting the freedom of migrants, and especially for applying it in Spain. Even if it's an exceptional measure, it's been applied in an arbitrary way because it's not done as a sole remedy. Around 1,000 people are sent to detention centers every month. It can't be considered an exceptional measure.
Corruption and the way they rule. It's said that in Africa there are dictators, but in my opinion, in Europe there are dictators as well.
I just wanted to avoid what is behind, you know?
In the limelight.
Whenever there is a show of solidarity with Palestine or blasting the Zionist regime's attacks against Palestinians in any corner in the world, Western regimes try to label it as anti-Semitism. Multiple U.S. cities have adopted a definition of anti-Semitism that silences Palestinians and expands surveillance. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truthout noted, in multiple cities across the U.S., the right-wing push for new laws to silence criticism of the Zionist regime for its human rights violations has reached a crescendo. As part of a growing international effort, The Zionist regime lobby groups have convinced local jurisdictions in several U.S. states to adopt the controversial and overbroad definition of anti-Semitism used by the International Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, which classifies virtually all expression in support of Palestinian rights as anti-Jewish. In California, the West Hollywood, Manhattan Beach, and Los Angeles City Councils each adopted the IHRA definition in the last 2 months. In Maryland, the Montgomery County Council did the same on November 2nd. The adoption of the IHRA definition comes amid recent high-profile incidents of anti-Semitism, namely Kanye West's incendiary comments about Jewish people, and former President Trump hosting outspoken white nationalists, Nick Fuentes at his Mar-a-Lago estate just a week after announcing his 2024 run. Indeed, those in Montgomery County who voiced support for that definition reference West's hateful comments as an example of why it needed to be enshrined as policy. However, while purporting to combat anti-Semitism, the IHRA definition is primarily designed to shield